Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, July 8, 2015, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome as our guest today two people, Judith Miller. She's author and senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute in New York City. She'll be joined by Dr. Arthur L. Herman. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute here in Washington, and he's a historian and New York Times bestselling author. His works include Freedom's Forge, a book about the retooling of America's big industry during the lead-up to World War II, Scottish Enlightenment, How the Scots Invented the Modern World, and Gandhi and Churchill, the epic rivalry that destroyed an empire and forged our age. He's also an author of a recent article in Commentary Magazine. It appeared in the May 15th, 2015 issue of Commentary Magazine. It's called The Smearing of Scooter Libby, and it will be among the many topics that we discuss today. Dr. Arthur Miller is going to conduct a conversation with author Judith Miller. So that'll be about the first 15, 20, 25 minutes of our program here today. But then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions. So please do be ready with your questions. And with that, Dr. Herman. I'm sorry, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. On January 16th, 2007, a trial began of the former chief of staff to then Vice President Dick Cheney. A trial involving a five-count indictment for obstruction of justice, making false statements, and perjury, all regarding a Bush administration leak of a CIA operative's identity, the CIA operative being Valerie Plame. Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald then conducted this trial on the five counts for the next several months. It weighed national headlines. It was a day-to-day drama that kept the American media and American public focused on the issues surrounding Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, the justifications for going to war in Iraq, but also questions about the Bush administration's conduct with regard to critics involved in questioning key decisions made about that war, including Valerie Plame's husband, diplomat Joe Wilson. In the end, four of the five counts were either thrown out or acquitted by the 12-person jury sitting in the case. There was, however, one count of lying to prosecutors, which did, in fact, Fitzgerald did, in fact, manage to get a conviction. And that conviction turned, to a very great extent, on the testimony of a then New York Times reporter, Judith Miller. Judith Miller, veteran journalist, longtime observer of Middle East politics, someone who had followed the weapons of mass destruction story very closely, and who had discussed with Scooter Libby key issues relating to the discovery of WMDs. Her testimony became crucial to making Fitzgerald's case that Scooter Libby had, in the course of discussions over WMDs and issues arising from Joe Wilson's criticisms in a New York Times op-ed, had in fact lied to federal prosecutors about what he had said and when he had said it. Today, Judith Miller has a very different view of both the role of her testimony in the case and also of Fitzgerald's role in eliciting that testimony. Her recent book, which has been out now. Judith, how long has the book been out?
It came out in April.
Came out in April. Her book, The Story, A Reporter's Journey, recounts the Scooter Libby trial, the events surrounding it, Fitzgerald's eliciting of testimony from Judith Miller, and also her conclusion that she has reached now that that testimony was wrong, and that by implication that Scooter Libby was wrongly convicted. Judith, let me ask you a question. And it's important, I think, for us to understand the atmosphere in which not just the trial took place in 2007, but the atmosphere surrounding the WMD case, of the way in which the public furor that arose when it turned out that the massive stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction weren't in fact there, and the way in which a firestorm of criticism descended upon the Bush administration, and the kinds of discussions that arose from that, and that you found yourself, as a matter of fact, right in the middle of it.
Right. I think the context, Arthur, is very, very important, and I'm glad you raised it, because I had been working in Washington, around Washington, for 35 years as a reporter, but not since Vietnam had I encountered such bitterness, such partisan rancor. People were actively looking for scapegoats, for people to blame for the war, for the conduct of the war, the decision to go to war. And I think the fact that so many people blamed Vice President Cheney and his chief of staff, Scooter Libby, was partly reflected the support that so many normally skeptical people gave to the decision to prosecute Scooter Libby. I think the whole context of the Libby prosecution has to be seen in that as a reflection of that rancor, of that anger and fury. And I think that holding the trial, even in 2007, when the war, remember, was still going badly, the surge
right.
not taking effect, that, you know, getting a jury of in a largely, overwhelmingly Democratic city where feelings about the war and the Bush administration ran high was another really pitiful decision that the judge made. But looking back on that whole trial, it's hard to imagine, given the context, the political context, that Scooter Libby ever could have gotten a fair trial if he should have been tried in the first place, which I've come to believe he shouldn't have been.
And I know there were a number of commentators who felt at the time the same way, that the case was really making a mountain out of a molehill, and that was really involved in really more political decisions than it was in questions about real legal guilt or legal innocence. Let's go into some of the details for a second. Your testimony that you gave in the trial in 2007 was really about conversations that had taken place almost 4 years earlier,
right.
in 2003. And the main focus from the point of view of Special Prosecutor Fitzgerald were notes that you had taken from particularly two conversations with Scooter Libby when he was still Cheney's chief of staff regarding WMDs. Can you spell that out for us about just how what those two conversations were and what it was about the notes that aroused Fitzgerald's interest?
Well, what I described in my book is the notes I had made of my conversation with Scooter Libby when I had returned from Iraq. I had spent four very frustrating months, exhilarating in some ways, that is covering the U.S. Army's hunt for WMD as part of embedded in a U.S. Army unit. And I had returned with a whole bunch of questions about why WMD, that everyone believed, including 16 intelligence agencies that are paid billions of dollars to get this right, that there was WMD there. And not having found it, I came back with a lot of questions. And I called up Scooter Libby, whom I barely knew, but I called his assistant and I said I needed to talk to him about what went wrong with the intelligence, how we could have gotten this so wrong if there was no WMD there. Just before that, there had been the leak of the name of an agent, Valerie Plame, And this was, for me, not nearly as important as the reason I was going to see the vice president's chief of staff, which was, you know, trying to figure out how we could have gotten this so wrong. And in the course of my notes...
Just for a second to back up first, so we understand where how Plame comes into this.
Right.
Her husband had gone to Niger to investigate whether Saddam Hussein, Iraq's dictator, had been looking for uranium that could be enriched for manufacturing a nuclear weapon. He had come back from that trip and published an op-ed piece, New York Times op-ed piece, saying that in fact, there was no evidence that Saddam Hussein had been looking for yellow cake uranium, as it was called, this sort of easy to enrich grade uranium that Niger was prepared to export, and that therefore this cast considerable doubt on the idea that there was any real legitimate reason to think about WND program. Now, what we now know, and was in fact known at the time by those who had read Wilson's report after his trip, was that was not true. That there was indeed evidence that Saddam Hussein's agents had been looking for yellow cake uranium. That the New York Times column, in fact, was wrong, and that Wilson knowingly falsified the results of his own report. In the discussion about that, now, and correct me if I'm wrong, what had happened was that a phone call went out to columnist Robert Novak from Richard Armitage, who was Deputy Secretary of State for Colin Powell, letting him know that Wilson's trip had not been by accident, that in fact he had been sent at the behest of his wife, who was in fact a CIA operative. And that was the leak. That was the leak that was reported and then confirmed in Novak's column that sent this whole furor off about the leaking of a CIA operative and her name and who had done it. And we can come back to that when we talk about Fitzgerald's role in all this. But the point is that we want to emphasize is that your conversation with Libby had nothing to do with the issue of the Plame case, let alone even the Wilson case.
Right. I mean, I had heard, obviously, about the leak. And there was a rumor going around that there was some connection between this between Wilson and Valerie Plame. I mean, one thing that I had been told was that, and I couldn't confirm it, so obviously I hadn't written it, was that she had gotten her husband the job for the CIA of going out and looking into this Niger business. So, you know, you could argue that reporters had some reason to kind of explore it, but the furor over the leak of this name, and they said she was a covert agent, and they had put the leak had put the national security in danger, and this was the most serious leak since, you know, I can't even remember what it was being compared to at the time, but it was taken very, very seriously, and of course, such leaks are a potential violation of the law, the Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 1982, which said that if you knowingly leak the name of an agent, and you know you do that to put the nation in danger, you can be prosecuted. So that's how the whole Patrick Fitzgerald investigation began. And
That was the seed for the special prosecutor.
Right, exactly. Because
your conversations with Scooter Libby had been quite separate from that, but now suddenly those notes from those conversations seemed extremely relevant for making Fitzgerald's case. And why was that?
Exactly. Because in parentheses, in my notes, after which began with my first question to Mr. Libby, which was the intel slanted? In other words, I wanted to know whether or not anybody had been fooling around with the intelligence or had, pressured analysts into saying something they didn't believe. In the course of that conversation, I had in parentheses a rather enigmatic notation, wife works in bureau, ?
Right.
And, you know, looking back, the first time I was asked about this was a year later. I didn't appear before the grand jury until 2 years later, That was my first appearance, and I thought, what on earth did that mean? But I was even a little uncertain at the time why I had written that. Did I mean, did the wife, I thought at the time that maybe I meant a non-proliferation bureau. Did the wife? Anyway, I concluded based on that.
There was certainly no reason for you, when you write down a word bureau in Washington speak,
it doesn't mean the CIA.
It can mean a range of other things. But
that's right. And I, you see, I didn't know then where what division Valerie Plame worked in or what her cover had been. I just had this bizarre, enigmatic, ambiguous notation in my notebooks. But I remembered, falsely it turned out, but I remembered having talked to several people. I definitely had talked to virtually everybody about it, but I thought I had talked to Scooter Libby about it, and that notation indicated that I had. And there was another conversation that was similar to that, which I had also completely forgotten about, because once again, I was focused on what seemed to me the all-consuming issue of why we had gone to war and why the intelligence had been wrong about someone we'd been watching for so long, Saddam Hussein. You know, how could we have gotten this wrong? To me, Valerie Plame, Joe Wilson, all of this was a bit of a I don't want to diminish the leak of an agent's name,
no.
But it just wasn't my lane. And
no, and it seemed a rather sort of side issue from
yes, definitely a side issue.
Yeah.
And so I hadn't focused on it, but once I had quickly figured out, as a lot of reporters did, the relationship between them. In fact, Valerie Plame was married to Joe Wilson. She must have read his column before it appeared in the New York Times, one assumed. She knew that what he was writing, or should have known, was incorrect. But the reason that column was so important was it was the first time that anyone who was in a position of authority, and that is a former ambassador, accused the administration of deliberately misleading the country into war, of lying the country into a war. And Joe Wilson's column is where the "they lied, people died" bumper sticker really started.
Right, that's right.
And that became very important politically, immediately scooped up by the Democrats who opposed the administration, immediately picked up by people who saw Dick Cheney, and in particular, as the kind of Darth Vader of the administration, and so the guns were out for him. So anyway, out for anyone associated with him.
And this is what, and it was precisely that political firestorm that pressured the Justice Department to, number one, appoint a special prosecutor.
Right.
In the Plame case.
Yes.
And number two, to begin the process of winnowing through any kind of testimony, any sort of documentation that would point the way to who, in fact, had carried out the leak.
Right.
Now, the irony, and I want to say the irony, but it may, I think as you learn the truth, as you do from reading your book, and as subsequently came out, I think it's hard to reach for a word that expresses the kind of the gravity of what was in fact happening, is that even as Fitzgerald launched himself on his special prosecutor hunt for the Valerie Plame leaker, he knew who it was even before he started the special prosecutor investigation.
Exactly. Even before we knew, he knew that the person who had initially leaked the name and the job of Valerie Plame to Robert Novak was not a critic of the war, was a critic of the war, not someone who supported the war. So the whole notion...
This was Richard Armitage.
Exactly. Armitage worked for Colin Powell, and Colin Powell, as we all now famously know, was an internal skeptic of the war. He had been skeptical. He didn't oppose it. He actually endorsed it when the president asked him directly, but he was in the skeptical camp. So this notion that Joe Wilson was being punished for criticizing the administration, why would Richard Armitage want to punish the man who had shared many of his doubts about whether or not the evidence for war was worthwhile? It just didn't make any sense. But the public didn't learn that until 2006, which was you know, 1 year before the trial, but certainly a year after the grand jury investigations began.
How much is his case? He
was never charged.
He was never charged. And in fact, Fitzgerald told him to keep quiet about the fact that he was, in fact, a leaker, because Fitzgerald was focused on, by then, on one person and one person alone as being able to pin the leaked identity, leaking the identity, and that was Scooter Libby. Now, why was Fitzgerald so intent on going after Scooter Libby? Did it have to do with the fact that he was chief of staff to the most unpopular man in Washington, as you said, the Darth Vader of Washington, Dick Cheney?
Yeah, I think it did have to do with that. And you know, one reason I wrote this book was that I finally went back and looked at my own testimony, looked at what I had written about WMD, and I got a chance to talk to Scooter Libby's lawyer about what had happened beforehand. Robert Tate had not agreed to talk to me. He was the lawyer. I needed Scooter Libby's permission for that. But I eventually did interview him, and Robert Tate told me an extraordinary thing. He basically said that he had gone out to Chicago to talk about the charges against his client, Scooter Libby, and Fitzgerald had met with him and had basically said, you know, if you turn over the vice president, if you can indicate that the vice president was the one who authorized the leak of this name or authorized you to say what you said, all of the charges against your client, that is Scooter Libby, will go away and the case would be over. And it became clear to Tate at that point, and he hadn't really said this publicly until my book, it became clear that this was that the prosecution of Scooter Libby was primarily, or at least a very important reason for it, was to try and nail the leak of this agent or lying to special prosecutors and the government on the vice president. And this was in the midst of a war that was going very badly.
And also a way in which, for a special prosecutor, you can make quite a name for yourself as being the man who got the vice president's chief of staff to roll and to basically rat him out for something he didn't do, but that which the American public and a large section of Washington would have believed was quite capable of doing, namely endangering the life of a CIA operative in order to punish her for her husband's op-ed column. I mean, when you spell it out this way, it really seems absurd, doesn't it? Chain of intention involved with it. But again, in the charged atmosphere.
That's why everything has to be seen in that atmosphere. And also, I can't get into Patrick Fitzgerald's motivations. I had a fair amount to do with it. I had a couple of cases with him, against him. He kept me in jail for 80 days.
For not revealing a source.
There was a misunderstanding between Mr. Tate and my lawyers about whether or not I was being granted permission to cooperate with this investigation. And until I got that permission, I wasn't going to cooperate. So I sat in jail. And in fact, I'm the only one in the entire Scooter Libby prosecution and the Valerie Plame outing who has ever gone to jail in this instance for a story I never wrote. I never wrote a word about Valerie Plame's outing about the Joe Wilson saga, nothing at all. But I sat in jail because I thought it was important to protect my sources, and I stayed even after I got a waiver from Scooter Libby's. We straightened out the confusion eventually, but I stayed there to protect my other sources, to make sure that Patrick Fitzgerald would not be able to ask me about anybody else that I had talked to about the Plame outing, and couldn't raise any other issues, because I was very afraid of what else might be in my notebooks. I stayed in jail so I didn't have to turn over my notebooks, and I didn't have to talk about any other source or any other conversation other than matters directly related to this prosecution.
Well, that case certainly made Frederick Fitzgerald pay attention to you and to have you firmly in his mind now in the case against Scooter Libby. And as we know, all the other charges basically fell apart.
Right.
The evidence supporting them. And it was the evidence that he was able to, a testimony he was able to elicit from you about those 2003, those notes on those 2003 conversations that really became the focus for his case.
Right. And that and Tim Rutherford.
Particularly that word, that you word bureau. This was the bureau he kept hammering at. What did that mean?
Well, when we were when he basically came to see me in jail after I got a waiver that I was satisfied with, he talked about what I had meant by that notation, and even though I thought I had a firm memory of having discussed this issue with Scooter Libby, I couldn't figure out what that notation was about. In other words, did I say wife works in bureau as something I wanted to raise with Scooter Libby or something he had said to me that I wanted to follow up on? I couldn't remember, but Fitzgerald kept focusing in on the word bureau. What did you mean by that? Did you mean FBI? FBI? No, I said. Normally, when I use the word bureau in Washington, I do mean the FBI, but I knew that Valerie Plame did not work at the FBI. I knew she worked at the CIA, so why would I use that word? And I couldn't remember. I just couldn't remember. It wasn't until years later, until I started researching this book in 2010, started looking back at this case, that I learned from Valerie Plame's own book, which of course hadn't been published when I was sitting in jail, that her cover as a CIA agent overseas was at a State Department bureau, the Bureau of Consular Affairs, an economic bureau. So it suddenly snapped in my memory that my reference to the word bureau had not meant the FBI, as Patrick Fitzgerald kept asking me, but it had meant the State Department bureau. But I never knew that Valerie Plame, until I read her book, I never knew that that had been her cover. So I had...
And Scooter Libby and his lawyers didn't know.
Didn't know that, because they too had asked Fitzgerald for information about her cover job and had been denied that information. So all of us were kind of operating in the dark. Had I been told at the time that that was her cover, I think I wouldn't have misremembered having had a conversation with Scooter Libby about her. Actually, now I really think that the two of us never did talk about Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson. We talked about Joe Wilson because Scooter Libby was so angry at the charges that he was leveling in the New York Times at the administration. I mean, he believed firmly that the administration's judgment to go to war was based on the high confidence decision, recommendation of the intelligence communities that it was their belief that Saddam had WMD. And it wasn't just America's CIA that believed that. It was the French intelligence, and France and Germany didn't want to particularly go to war. It was Israeli intelligence. It was British intelligence. And I know that because I had done the reporting and all of those countries, and they all agreed that Saddam had WMD. So, you know, Libby was really angry, but he was angry at the fact that someone who had been to Niger for 6 minutes on a CIA mission would turn around and accuse the administration of lying the country into war. That's a very serious charge. So I remembered his anger. I remember firmly having talked to him about Joe Wilson, but the wife, that was very fuzzy in my memory.
And Fitzgerald took advantage of that because even as he was pushing you about the wife, what does bureau mean, he knew perfectly well what the bureau meant. And that his ability to convince you that somehow that had to be CIA all took place with his full knowledge that this was, in fact, a reference to her State Department bureau employment. Now, the fact that he would not reveal this to you in order to elicit what was in fact actually then false testimony is one thing, but
well, inaccurate.
He also withheld that evidence, including Valerie Plame's employment history, from Scooter Libby's lawyers.
Right.
Seems to me yet an even more grave situation. In fact, it's true, isn't it, that Libby's lawyers asked about Plame's State Department, Plame's past employment history. Fitzgerald said it was irrelevant, which of course it was not. The judge in the case, Reggie Walton, backed him up because Fitzgerald knew that if they were to see the reference to working in State Department Bureau, one of the bureaus of the State Department, that they would put two and two together and realize that that's what the word bureau meant, not CIA at all.
Right. I mean, that I can only assume that. I tried to interview Patrick Fitzgerald for my book, and I not only wanted to talk to him about, you know, this case, but another case involving telephone records that he had against me, but I didn't, he didn't want to talk to me, even though after he left the Justice Department, he went to work for the law firm that represented me in this case. So
well,
he is sitting in the Chicago branch of that law firm, but he was not willing to talk to me. I sent him emails. I sent him registered letters. I tried to intervene, get him to talk to me through friends. He wouldn't. So his own motivation, what led him to do this, he will have to explain one day, I hope. But that's just the issue. What really depresses me about my book is the fact that I had assumed that once I discussed the fact that I believed I had given an accurate testimony based on subsequent reporting that into the case that I had done, I thought that newspapers all over the country would pick that up. But if you're a reader of the New York Times or the Washington Post, you do not know to this day that I have recanted my testimony based on information I subsequently learned, that you don't know that Tate told me for my book that basically the Fitzgerald had tried to roll Scooter Libby to get the vice president, you know, another prosecutorial scalp. You don't know those facts. You don't know that the absence of Scooter Libby might, in fact, have delayed the implementation of the surge and the conduct of the war.
He was
all of these things I deal with in my book.
For a major change in the strategy in Iraq shortly after the fall of Saddam Hussein.
Right.
And it is quite possible if he hadn't been weighed down first by the investigation and then by the attacks in the media, and then also by the investigation subsequent indictment, he may well have been someone to force a change and to bring the surge years before it in fact took place.
Exactly. I document in my book exactly the steps that Scooter Libby took to try and get a shift in policy almost from the beginning of the war. I mean, it was Libby and the vice president's office that understood early on that the war was going south, that we needed to switch strategies. But he was the firmest and fiercest advocate of a shift in policy, but he was completely under siege because of this case. And, of course, once he was indicted, he was forced out entirely. And so the administration, those pushing in the administration for a shift in strategy lost their most effective advocate with his removal. But you know none of that if you only read the New York Times and the Washington Post, because those two papers have never to this day covered any of this, any of what we're talking about today. And I, as a former New York Times reporter, find that absolutely shocking. We used to say you're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts. Now it seems that these mainstream newspapers have decided that the American people don't really need to know the facts surrounding this very politically fraught period.
No, I think
it is a great shame.
I think they've stonewalled this case, and they've allowed the story to remain in place when, in fact, it has really sort of lost all of its validity. And as for Scooter Libby himself, we can really conclude here that his conviction was wrong, that his public career was ruined, He was disbarred, paid a $250,000 fine, and was very nearly sent to jail until President Bush commuted his sentence at the last minute, all for a crime which he didn't do, that the special prosecutor knew he hadn't committed, and what was on the basis of a charge of perjury, of lying to federal investigators, which Fitzgerald knew was itself based on false testimony, namely the false testimony he had elicited from you. It seems to me that this is a case that really cries out for some kind of reevaluation, if not outright exoneration, certainly of Scooter Libby, at least, and this is, I think, the point that you're getting to, Judith, at least for telling the truth and for getting this real story of what happened and what the implications were out there to the American public and into the and through the media.
I mean, Arthur, my book basically argues that journalism is the first draft of history, and that we as journalists are under an obligation to always go back and revisit what we've written to see whether or not it's accurate or it's not accurate. And that's what I was trying to do in this book. So quite apart from the issue of guilt or innocence, is what I wanted to do was go back and say, knowing now, if we had known then what we now know, would the story be very different? And the answer for me was definitely in my case. And I felt, after learning what I learned about Scooter Libby, that even if I never changed anyone's mind about why we had gone to war in Iraq, that perhaps I would change their minds about what he had been convicted of, based since I had contributed to that. I had an obligation as a journalist, as a citizen, to go back and look at what I had done. And weirdly enough, that's what everyone praised me for, you know, defending the First Amendment, free speech, going to jail. I knew once I began investigating this case that I had made a terrible mistake, based in part on a memory problem called misattribution, but in part because of the questions that I was asked by Mr. Fitzgerald, and that I had an obligation to set the record straight, which is what I've done or tried to do. And that's, you know, we're always going to get things wrong, but failing to correct the record is the major journalist sin, not getting things wrong. We all do that.
And also, too, I think the other issue you have to ask is the question about the prosecutor misconduct. What are the penalties for that? What are the ways in which one reexamines and has and evaluate why these things have happened and what the implications are? And it seems to me, Dean, that this is a kind of an issue that would be of interest both to federal society, but also to people listening to this conversation.
Right, and Arthur, your article goes a long way to kind of raising these crucial issues. It is one of the best summaries of this case and what happened, and the very important judicial questions raised by this episode.
Well, I appreciate that, Judith. In the interest of full disclosure, Scooter Libby is a colleague of mine here at the Hudson Institute. But when I arrived here at the Hudson Institute, I certainly didn't know the full story. I had a sense that there had been some sort of, shall we say, prosecutorial hanky-panky involved in his indictment and conviction, and that the Valerie Plame so-called leak case was really a tempest in a teapot. But your book and the subsequent accounts that have come out, including from CIA's own general counsel, John Rizzo, really make it clear that the way in which this story has been presented to the public, like Scooter Libby's own conviction, is false.
Yeah, I mean, she. What's truly amazing is John Rizzo, the former CIA general counsel, whom you write about and whom I write about, because he. It turns out the CIA did an internal investigation of the impact of the leak, and they found, of her name, and they found no damage to national security, no sources that were endangered, and no damage even to her. In other words, she had been kind of taken out of the covert agent game long before this whole thing started.
Yeah, in fact, he says in his book,
right.
2014 book, Company Man,
yes. company.
So she was so obscure that I don't even recall hearing her name, much less.
Right. Right. And he also pointed out that she did not have to leave the agency. That was her choice. But that she certainly wasn't helped by her husband. That is John Rizzo's argument that, you know, his publicity seeking, his accusations against the administration made it very difficult for her to stay on.
Oh, it's true. And if it turns out that there's, I mean, there's plenty of scoundrels in this story.
Oh, no shortage of scoundrels.
No shortage of scoundrels. But I think what you have to list among the top two or three is definitely Joe Wilson himself. That he, I think, really tried to present what was the WMD case, in the case of looking for Yale Cake uranium, in a totally false light, knowingly so, and in the end was actually found out when subsequent investigations by by the Senate and also by the Rob Silverman commission working on the WMD problem, really made it clear that Wilson's version of events in his op-ed was false through and through from the very start.
Right. Well, people come to believe their own narratives, and I'm sure Mr. Wilson believes what he wrote. But, you know, as someone who had dealt in public policy, surely he should have known that even if he believed that what the administration was saying about uranium was not true, there was other evidence that pointed to the existence of a nuclear program on the part of Saddam Hussein, and that he would not be in a position to know what that evidence was unless he and his wife were talking about it. But, you know, this is, the narrative, the they lied, people died, played very well into this, this charges. It's very useful for Democrats to argue that we were lied into the war, even though it was a little bit embarrassing for Hillary Clinton and for other key Democrats, all of whom had supported the war. But you would not know that today, given what they now say.
Arthur, this is Dean. Let me interject here and move to the audience and see if they have some questions. Mm-hmm. So in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button. I want to reiterate the name of the book we're talking about today. It's The Story, A Reporter's Journey. It's by Simon & Schuster, and it's available now. If you got a notice of this call, it's the link to the Amazon page is in the notice of today's call. We've also been talking about the Commentary Magazine article by Arthur Herman, The Smearing of Scooter Libby. That's in the May 15th, 2015 edition of Commentary Magazine. And Arthur, I'm going to just take a moment to respond to what you said about prosecutorial misconduct. That is a great concern of the Federalist Society. You know, we have 15 different practice groups here. One of them is a criminal law practice group. Another is a professional responsibility practice group. And they are keenly focused on the idea that nobody has more to lose than when they face a criminal prosecution. Criminal prosecutions, by definition, mean that there is the full weight and power of the state versus an individual. So there's a great deal at stake. We've done a lot of work and debating criminalization of politics and criminalization of governing, which is a particularly troublesome phenomenon when the people in power and control of the government bring cases against potential political rivals or others for political reasons. And this is all exacerbated and seemingly worsened when you consider the institutions of the independent prosecutor or the special prosecutor, which in some ways those problems might be less because they might be less political if you have somebody who truly is independent of the levers of politics. But they're also special prosecutors and independent prosecutors a lot of times untethered to the same extent they're independent. So they might have an extremely wide-ranging mandate. They might have very little supervision. They might have a virtually unlimited budget. So a lot of the problems we're talking about here today are not new to the Federalist Society. At least the themes are not new, although the particulars here are very interesting and are new. Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two callers with questions so far, so let's take our first call of the day here.
I practice law in Chicago, and I rather suspect that Mr. Fitzgerald or someone on his behalf is participating in this call, so I won't identify myself further. But when he first came to Chicago, he was seen as a breath of fresh air, an outsider who was not subject to the political control of what's known here as the Combine, the Republican hierarchy working in hand in glove with the Democratic establishment of the state. What do you think went wrong between this truly independent prosecutor who was not tethered to any political party and what happened in this case?
That's a good question. And like Judith, I'm not in a position to step out and try to say that I can understand the workings of Fitzgerald's mind. And hey, I know people who speak very highly of him as a prosecutor, particularly in the Blind Shake case. You can go and talk to Andy McCarthy about that, who worked with him there and thought, as you were saying too, that here's this prosecutor who has got who's immune to political pressures, who is forthright in his approach, and who is someone who is upfront and scrupulously honest in his dealings in these cases. I think what we have to back up, though, and consider is the very different public atmosphere in the first World Trade Center bombing in the Blind Shake case, and the atmosphere of 2003-2004 surrounding the Iraq War and the events taking place in Iraq, but also unfolding in Washington, where the Bush administration seemed to be rocked on its hinges, and indeed very much looked like it might be a one-term administration. I don't think it would take very much to convince someone holding the kind of power that Fitzgerald had as special prosecutor to realize that this is a kind of atmosphere in which it would be better to be on the winning side politically of where things will turn out when all is said and done, and when the dust is finally cleared from this whole WMD debacle and the war in Iraq, and who has decided that this is the way in which he's going to proceed in dealing with this kind of case. I think it's also, too, it must be a enormous temptation when you are basically given a blank slate, as Fitzgerald was. His deputy attorney general told him, follow this anywhere it goes. It would be hard in that situation to take a case like this where you want it to go, regardless of what the actual facts and circumstances are. I guess that's about the best explanation I can give to you. What you have to look at is simply the facts on the ground, the facts about the case, and the way in which Fitzgerald basically, I think it's pretty clear, was involved in some serious misconduct.
I can't get into his head. I don't know what motivated him. And I do know that in other terrorism cases, as Arthur pointed out, he has been a fierce advocate of punishing those who would do harm to this country. And in fact, after I got out of jail, after I testified in court, I actually went to Chicago to testify in a terrorism case that he was conducting against someone who was accused of providing material support for Hamas and other terrorist organizations. So I actually wound up testifying as his witness, being a witness for him in that case. And it's kind of, for me, looking at Fitzgerald, I see Fish got to swim, birds got to fly, prosecutors got to prosecute, and the more vigorously you do that, you know, the better it is normally, except when you get involved in such a highly political case like this, in which so much is at stake.
So many ways to turn your head and to make you think that the end will ultimately justify the means you've taken.
Yeah, I mean, I think he really does think that Scooter Libby misled him and the FBI. And rather than just assuming that this was a guy who was working from 6 o'clock in the morning till 11 or 12 o'clock every night, 6 days a week, and half of that on Sunday, and that he misremembered something. I mean, prosecutors tend to see evil where perhaps just memory failure with everything going on. And when I looked at Scooter Libby's schedule, which I present in the book, it was daunting. And I could see how you might forget hearing and from whom you learned that Valerie Plame was a CIA agent who had helped send her husband to, you know, Niger to look at evidence in WMD. I can see that you might forget that fact, given everything he was dealing with.
Which was only one aspect
right.
of the whole WMD issue.
Right.
In comparison with the other kinds of issues having to do with chemical and biological weapons. And stuff.
Right.
The nuclear issue was only one part of the overall question of identifying WMDs after the war, finding out that those stockpiles were not there, even though the programs were there to be started up again when Saddam felt it was feasible to do so. Right. And then dealing with, of course, kind of reverse engineering, figuring out how so many intelligence agencies managed to get this so completely wrong.
Right.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question remaining, and then our lines are wide open. Let's take another call here.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Thank you for an excellent exposition on an insight into a episode in history and a miscarriage of justice. But I think it's important to recognize, first of all, that the motives of Fitzgerald doesn't necessarily have to be corruption. It can also be fanaticism as a common cause of misconduct. And while it is important to examine this from a historical standpoint, this is a legal forum. And I think I would like you to explore what are some of the areas of structural and procedural reform that might be made in order to avoid such problems going forward, such as perhaps the repeal of Title 18, Section 1001 and 1510, which provide the basis for criminal prosecution of persons for making false statements to government investigators, which is being much abused against many people every day. And your book may provide an important prick of the bubble that seems to surround most people in the higher realms of experience that it can't happen to them because it can.
Dean, since I'm not a lawyer, I don't even play one on TV. Do you want to field that one and see what and bring out some of the key issues that reside on that question?
Well, I'm tempted to do that, but we've got 5 minutes left. I see another caller here.
Oh, okay.
And I really want to give over the time to you and Judith Miller, if that's okay.
That's
Let's
fine.
See if this, okay. Let's see if this next question is something you want to take on.
Yes, my name is Bill Otis. I'm now a part-time law professor at Georgetown, but I spent many years as an assistant U.S. attorney, a federal prosecutor. I also wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post a month before President Bush commuted the prison sentence part for Scooter Libby, although leaving the fine in place, suggesting that the president do that, that commutation was just in this case, although a pardon would not be just. And the question I have is this, whether it is actually, and I apologize, I missed the first 35 minutes of this call, I had to be somewhere else, but the question is whether the federal government can release as easily as the last caller suggested, 1001 and 1015, the false statement statute. My experience as a prosecutor is that doing anything that could be identified as justice depends on the government's being able to demand and get the truth. People who are being asked by the questions, the Supreme Court has a famous case from years ago in which it said that there are many mechanisms for a person who is being interviewed to bring before a court the question whether the government should be asking those questions. Lying is not one of them. I want to ask our panelists whether they think that the government should relinquish its right to demand the truth, whether it thinks that prosecutors in any sense routinely abuse their insistence on that demand, whether Scooter Libby didn't have the opportunity to put before a jury of his peers the question whether it was just forgetfulness, and whether overall there has been as much unfairness and prosecutorial abuse as has been alleged here. And again, I do this having recommended publicly in the Washington Post that the sentence was too long, that Scooter Libby is not the kind of man that, in my experience, has a criminal turn of mind, that he's actually more of a patriot than anything else, and that while I might have my questions about the wisdom of the prosecution, certainly the wisdom of the sentence, that I do think we are entering perilous waters if we put aside the government's right to expect and get the truth. And I'll listen to the answer.
I can answer that very quickly. I totally agree with you. But I think the real question here was not whether Scooter Libby was telling the truth, but whether the prosecutor was, and whether he was eliciting false testimony, knowing that that testimony was false. And I can recommend to you going over the podcast. The first 35 minutes, I think, would have made it clear to you that that's really the focus of this issue, and also the focus, too, about the question of whether of Scooter Libby's exoneration. I think if we're going to end on a note here of some kind of where do we go forward here, questions about how federal prosecutors operate and the statutes under which they operate is, I think, totally fair and certainly subject to important debate by legal experts and by those like yourself who've been involved in the prosecutorial process. But what we also have here is clearly that given Judith Miller's subsequent account and her own now memory of what had happened and how her testimony was falsified and elicited, and I have to say that what Scooter Libby deserves now is not a commutation of sentence or even a pardon, but exoneration. And it seems to me that that's the ultimate justice that's going to have to come out of this case.
Final thought from Judith Miller.
Bill, I do hope that you'll read the story, my book, and watch the podcast, listen to the podcast, and make your own decision based on the facts of the case as we came to know them. Of course, we all expect everyone to testify truthfully under oath, and everyone, the system demands that, but I came away from this experience as a reporter thinking that the, decision to put me in jail, a reporter in jail, the decision to issue subpoenas to so many journalists, to start jeopardizing the independence of the press, given what the prosecutor clearly knew at the time, the facts he had and we didn't at the time, raised some pretty profound questions about judgment, if nothing else. And I come away a firm critic of the special prosecutor system. I don't think we should have them based on what I've seen and experienced myself, but I do hope you'll you know, watch the podcast and read the book and see what
my article and commentary too, which I think also summarizes a lot.
And
of
yes, absolutely, and Arthur's article, which summarizes the facts in this case and very, very well.
And just in case others join the call late, the book again is entitled "The Story: A Reporter's Journey" by Judith Miller. It's a Simon & Schuster book. The article we've been talking about is "The Smearing of Scooter Libby" in Commentary Magazine by Arthur Herman, publication date May 15th, 2015. And with that, let me thank both of you for joining us today. This has been a fascinating discussion, I think. I want to also thank our audience for joining us and for their thoughtful questions. A reminder to our audience to check in on our website for upcoming Teleforum conference calls, but right now the next scheduled Teleforum call is tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be discussing an entirely different topic, and that's the CFPB's arbitration study, and we'll host Andy Pincus and Deepak Gupta. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. But until that next Teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.